This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. For this episode, I've gathered together a group of librarians to talk about their favorite books from 2012 and to give a little preview of 2013. The interviews ran a little long, so we're going to split this into two episodes. So here's part one, and we're going to start off with a discussion about the importance of reading in libraries by librarians Liz Burns and Kelly Jensen.
Reading in libraries, what I think sometimes happens, to be fair, is it's not as much that people perhaps want to get rid of books and reading, is that they get so enthusiastic for some new things or new ways of connecting with communities that they don't really realize that what they're in effect, what saying is, so we don't need no stinking books or reading. I don't think they always realize that that's the message they're sending, even though I think it's pretty clear from how Kelly and myself and you and others react to things that that's definitely one of the messages, intended or not, that they are sending.
Kind of going off that, though, it's like, you know, reading kind of doesn't have that sexy appeal that trying new things does. And I mean, as great as it is that we are trying new things, we can't forget the importance of reading and that it's really the bread and butter of what we're doing, especially in the public library. We want to offer more, but sometimes in doing that, we forget the basics.
It's like this, because, you know, you can't talk to me without me using a really wacky metaphor. To build off the bread and butter that Kelly mentioned, it's like the books are the bread in the library sandwich. And so you can go for your peanut butter or jelly or your fancy panini or whatever, but at the end of the day, you still need books. And when I say books, I'm including ebooks in that.
It's not the container. It's what's contained in the container.
Right. I mean, right. You can read an ebook just as well as you can read a paper book. It's not, or a magazine or a journal article or a website.
Exactly. When I'm saying I'm team book, it could be a hardcover, it could be a paperback, it could be what you're reading on your Nook or your Kindle or your phone, you know, or what you're listening to because it's an audiobook. All of that is that's all books.
I don't even know if it's so much team book as much as team reading, and I think that that's just as important.
Yes.
And I think it's fair. I think a lot of people, what they will then stereotypically say of people like you all or me at times is that then it's like, well, you're just trying to drag us back into the old ages. But I don't think anybody's saying that you don't do these experimental things, but it's just sort of that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of thing.
Right. Exactly. That, and that a lot of these new things can be even more exciting if you're keeping with the books and the reading, and that the idea that people are indeed saying, labeling that as old-fashioned or boring, well, then they're voicing their attitude towards something. Well, wait a minute, if that's how you feel towards the readers in your community, do you think they don't know that when they come through the door? One thing I think that people are always really good with, even if they can't exactly put a finger on it, is they know when they're not really welcome and they know when they're not being respected. I mean, heck, see, I didn't say it the bad way. I would imagine that you ask any romance reader who walks through the door in a library without it ever being said to them, they will be able to tell you which staff respects that they're romance readers and which ones are snickering behind the counter because of what it is they're reading. And so I do think that that's something that one of the reasons why we have to be careful how we proceed, because otherwise it'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy of the person saying, oh yeah, well, you know, books and readers are so passe. Well, that's because the books and readers have stopped coming in and talking to your library or to you because they know that's what you think about them. And then to go one step further with that, because I think books and readers are going to be around, if they're not welcome at their local library, they will find another place to go. And that's where, and then you have to deal with that consequence.
Ditto to all of that.
Right. I mean, we want to make the library a safe place for reading, that because I mean, Amazon is very happy to step in and do their little lending library thing and take you out and let people stay at home all day and do their read from them and buy from them. So I mean, we need to make our the experience a better one.
Right.
Exactly.
What we offer that Amazon doesn't offer is the human element to the whole thing. I mean, you can't get personalized recommendations from Amazon in a way that you can when you walk into a library. Sure, they offer you what other customers have purchased, but what other customers have purchased is not reader's advisory. It's not telling the person who's asking for help something that they're really looking for. And you can't quantify that.
And in addition to agreeing 100% with Kelly, I would also add that what the library offers that no bookstore offers is we're not concerned about selling the product. We're concerned about connecting the reader to the book. So for bookstores, if it's out of print, then that's not going to be something that they're going to consider. For a paper bookstore, if it, you know, there's things like that that get taken into account. For in the library, you're going to hear the reader talk, and it could be a book that's 5 or 10 years old, which might not be carried or is easier to find, or might not be being pushed by the Amazon algorithms of buy this, buy that. But we at the library are going to push it because we don't care about whether it's, you know, just the most recent things being sold or bestseller lists or things like that.
And again, it goes back to the old, you know, saying, every book a reader, every reader a book. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Right.
Well, very good. See, we can make discussions short sometimes. the main reason you guys are on today and why everyone else is not going to be on the episode after you guys is to give your lists of your favorite books that you read in 2012 and if you have some previews of things that you're looking forward to in 2013, you can mention those as well.
I just have to say that in trying to, like, you know, figure these lists, it can be really difficult for me because I tend to only finish what I like to begin with. So like when I went through my blog and marked and noticed what I had marked as favorite books, probably from the ongoing basis, I've definitely got maybe between 20 and 30 titles there, but it kind of skews that way. Anyway, if I'm going to have read it, it's going to be even more inclined to be a favorite. So then it's kind of like narrowing it down even further, which is like practically torture. But I can say that without any torture involved, that my favorite absolute book of 2012 happens to be a book that does involve torture, Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wen from Hyperion, that came out. And it is just, I might actually cry if it doesn't get any recognition at the ALA Media Awards later this month.
Oh, is that all you're going to say about it?
That I'm going to cry if it doesn't get something? I think that's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah, I'm not saying it isn't. I expected a lot more rambling from you about this, so I started taking notes on something else.
Well, I think some people like to keep episodes short sometimes, Kelly.
I listened to what Steve asked us to do and so have been accordingly keeping it short.
All right. Well, then I'll go. I decided to do my list a little bit differently. I've created some categories of...
Wait a minute. So is this going to be like Kirkus where instead of having like, you know, 10 best books, you're about to go through 200?
Actually, no. I limited myself to like 12 categories. So it's not too crazy.
All right, 12 categories, not even just 12 books, 12 categories.
I think she's serious.
No, there's only one book in each category.
Oh, well, okay.
Come on, this took some real effort on my part. So I guess the first thing I'll talk about is my favorite cancer book of the year. You know.
It's not going to be the one people think.
It's not. That was what I was going to talk about, is it seems everybody talked about a particular cancer book this year. That neither Liz nor myself have read, so neither of us can talk about the merits of that one. But I can talk a little bit about this cancer book that came out in March called Me and Earl and the Dying Girl by Jesse Andrews. And it was a debut novel in 2012. And it follows a boy named Greg who's kind of like, he gets by in school, but he's not the most spectacular student. And his mother decides to pair him up with this girl who he had known from a church group in the past, and she is dying of cancer. So Greg can think of nothing he wants to do less than go visit this girl and befriend her. And so while it sounds like it's a really kind of depressing story, it's actually quite funny. Greg wants to be a filmmaker, and so the story is told with a little bit of script writing in it, and he talks about some of the films that he's done. And you come to find out that the reason that he comes to enjoy his time with Rachel, the girl who has cancer, is because he's able to use his filmmaking skills to kind of help her get through this challenging time. It didn't make me cry.
Each book, I need to know how many tears you shed over it. So
that was a zero tear.
And I was going to bring this up at the end because you said to mention it earlier, but since you went ahead and brought it up, is there a reason that neither of you read, I'll go ahead and say the name of it even, The Fault in Our Stars?
The reason I haven't read The Fault in Our Stars is, one, I didn't get a review copy of it. So if I don't get a review copy of something, it does make it that much more difficult to read. Then also because then there are other things that I've gotten in as review copies or other projects in terms of what I'm reading. For example, through most of December and now January, my reading choices have been taken up with catching up with YALSA's finalists for the Morris Award and the Excellence in Nonfiction Award. So, you know, things like that happen. So I kind of just never got around to it. And then also sometimes with books, they get so much attention that I'm like, okay, this isn't a book that needs me to say anything for it. On the other hand, though, you've got a book coming out like Kiki Strike. The new Kiki Strike book is coming out later this month. I'm about halfway through. I am loving and adoring it. It is Kiki Strike is an amazing series. It's perfect for your middle school readers. It's got tremendous girl power. It's very smart. And in all honesty, I'd rather give my attention to that book, which is the third book in a series that began in 2006, so is not going to maybe get the attention that something by someone like John Green is going to be getting in the blogosphere. That said, because I get very, as you can tell from me reading the different finalists for the Morris and the Excellence in Nonfiction, if it gets a nod in at the end of the month from YALSA, then I'll be going to the local library and digging up a copy and reading it then.
The reason I haven't read it is actually more simplistic than that, and it's that I really don't like cancer books very much. I know that I picked that as a category to talk about, but I did that because I feel like it was a theme that went through a lot of 2012 YA books, so I ended up reading a lot of cancer stories, even though it's not my favorite topic. I feel like there's a lot of baggage that readers have to bring to a story about cancer, and so that's why I decided not to read it. And then as it got more and more and more attention, I decided to go ahead and give the first chapter a shot. So, spoiler alert, I actually read the first chapter of it, and it didn't hook me.
Zero tears.
Zero tears, yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to know, because obviously when people are making their big best of YA list, they all have that on there, so I just wanted to get an opinion from you guys of why.
And it wasn't just the best of YA. It was the best of, like, everything. You know, all those magazines that they read one YA book a year, right, were calling it the best, you know, book ever, which is
kind of like what Kelly is talking about, and then even what you're talking about, is it brings up some interesting points when we're talking about best lists. And even for that, when I look at my list at the end of the year, I really more call it a favorite list than a best list, because I'm talking about what are my personal favorites. And since my goal isn't to decide what were the best books of 2012, I also felt no reason that then I had to read some of the books out there in order to determine where or not it went on the list. Like, if my goal was at my blog to say, okay, now here in January, I'm going to say the 10 best books of 2012. I would have been tracking down a copy because it would have has gotten on so many lists that how could I create a best books list if I didn't read this very strong contender for it? So instead, it's much more my personal list. And that's also why I always find other people's best lists or favorite lists so interesting. If it's coming from a mainstream publication, who's been involved in that decision? What is it that they're looking for when they define best or favorite? Like, it's interesting Kelly saying that she's doing it by categories. So even then, it's not necessarily say what would be her five best books. It's her 12 best books that deal with these certain topics or subjects or areas.
Well, and, you know, the reason I decided to go this route was for that reason, is I couldn't come up with just a favorite and I couldn't come up with just a best. So I instead kind of thought about the trends that had emerged in 2012 and what books that I had read that fell into those sort of trends that I thought were standout titles, you know, which doesn't mean the best, doesn't necessarily mean my favorite, but just titles that stood out to me.
Right. So, Liz, what's the next book on your list?
The next book on my list is Froy of the Exiles by Melina Marchetta, published by Candlewick here in the U.S. It is Marchetta's, I think, more well-known for her realistic fiction, and this goes totally into fantasy. It's the second book in the series, and the third one, Quintana, is coming out, I believe it's April 9th. So put that down on books I'm looking forward in 2013. It's interesting because, as I said, the author is more known for her contemporary realistic fiction. And a strong point that she always has in those books, like The Piper's Son, is the ties of family and community. And in her Lumetier fantasy series, even though there's action and adventure and different fantasy elements, it's still, when it comes down to it, is about what makes up family and community. And the only thing I didn't like about Froy was that it ended on a tremendous cliffhanger. So I was very excited to be able to get my hands on the last one to see how that all ended and worked itself out. And I guess I cried at the end. We're going to go by the tear test, so.
Two tears up.
Two tears.
Kelly.
All right. So I'm going to talk about my favorite dystopia this year. Which was Megan McCafferty's Thumped. It's the sequel to Bumped, which came out in 2011. And it's a satire on dystopia in general, where two girls who, you know, they fall between a certain age range, they're sold to older people who can no longer have babies to carry these babies for them. That's the premise of the first book, Bumped. Thumped, the one out this year, one of the twin girls who was impregnated has the baby. And so it follows what she's going to do now that she's pretty much fulfilled her purpose in life by having this child. And it's hilarious. It's really funny, but at the same time, it really taps into a lot of what these dystopia novels are trying to do in talking about feminism and talking about issues of being sold and issues of being monitored and issues of having no control over the future of your own life. And I really appreciated how McCafferty is able to once critique the genre and at the same time offer something new to say about the genre. Period. End of statement.
You didn't mention crying or anything, so.
No crying. I did laugh. Apparently, this is going to be Kelly's list of books that made her laugh.
So Liz cries, Kelly laughs.
And in all honesty, between the crying and laughing, we're just talking about everybody too. So, and so far, I haven't responded really to any of Kelly's books on her list because so far they've been things that I haven't read. So,
well, they're good recommendations for you then.
We'll get there, Liz. We'll get there.
I'm sure. My turn.
Yes. What's the next book that made you cry this year?
Okay, it's not a book that made me cry, but it's still a book I liked. I Hunt Killers by Barry Liga, Little Brown. And I Hunt Killers is, well, first of all, I love mysteries, and I also like true crime. I like TV shows like Dexter. Half the TV shows I watch, believe it or not, are not reality TV shows, but are crime shows. So the I Hunt Killers is basically about the son of a serial killer, and the serial killing a new killing takes place in his hometown, and he pretty much has to investigate it to clear his name, because who do you think is who's the chief suspect? The son of a serial killer. And the sequel for that is out this coming year, called Game, I believe. And so I'm looking forward to that too. But it's just a nice, solid mystery. And at the same time is looking at questions of nature and nurture, in which case the main character in I Hunt Killers is basically out of luck both ways, because his biological father is a serial killer, and he was also raised by a serial killer to try to become a serial killer. So, you know, it's tough.
Family business.
Family business. Sometimes, you know, you try to get out and they pull you back in.
Kelly.
All right. Let's do the favorite place I traveled this year. And that came through Kristen Hubbard's Wanderlove. And I believe that came out in March or April. And that's a story about an 18-year-old girl named Bria, who she's just graduated high school, and she's going on a tour in Central America. She is set to go with this travel group, and they have all these prearranged places they're going to go and travel. She decides when she gets there to go off course and instead follows a group of backpackers around. There's some romance. There's some, you know, questioning of whether or not she wants to go to college right after she's done with high school now. She's not entirely sure where she wants to go. And it's through this traveling and meeting people who are completely different from her that she kind of figures out that it's okay to take a different path in life. I love feeling like I was there in Central America, that I was in different countries, and that I was seeing not just the touristy places, but I was seeing the real off-the-beaten-path places while I was reading it.
I actually read that book. I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed it probably all the more so because even though I definitely did my a couple of trips during college to Europe with a backpack, not anything quite like they do in Wanderlove. To be honest, I've liked going places where I've got know that there's going to be that clean bathroom with no bugs. But it was a really good book, and the other thing I liked about Wanderlove is that how the backpackers that she ran into were portrayed and had the depth of the characterization.
They were real backpackers, and it was interesting to read some of the reviews, the people talking about they didn't like them, but as somebody who spent a lot of time with like that backpacking group in college, not as a backpacker, but as somebody who knew a lot of those people, I mean, the portrayal is spot on. I mean, the characters were right on. They weren't just cardboard cutouts.
So you're saying you were a backpack groupie?
Something like that. I like showers. I require a shower every day. I like beds. I like, you know, modern conveniences. Like, you would never catch me out in the woods camping. Sorry.
See, I'm high maintenance that, too. You know, roughing it is when you don't have room service. Right, Kelly?
Right, right. This is why we room together all the time.
Are you guys rooming together at Midwinter?
Yes, we are. My turn?
Your turn.
My turn is a ghost story, Long Lenkin by Lindsay Barraclough. That's also Candlewick. And I'm pretty sure this one was recommended to me by Kelly. And it is a terrifically creepy, haunted house ghost story. It is set in the late 1950s in England, and it is also just a masterful telling of that post-war time period and how that then impacts the characters and what's going on there. I think I read some people weren't as in love with it because they thought it moved a little too slowly, but I thought it was just did a great sense of creating both this time, this place, and this increasing feeling of dread, that not everything that is horror is the chainsaw coming out of the closet in the first 2 seconds of a book. This has no chainsaws.
Oh, I loved it. I love the atmosphere that it had. And I think that that's where some people got caught up, is because it felt slow moving. But it was because Barraclough was doing such a good job building tension and atmosphere in the novel.
Sounds creepy.
Yes.
Yes.
And you should read it.
I will put it on my list with the other 50,000 books that Kelly is going to recommend for the rest of this next half hour.
Wow. Okay.
See, he's keeping you to a time limit. Ha 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 ha.
All right. So my next one is...
Kelly actually has to go to work soon, so we have to...
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Okay, go ahead, Kelly.
I don't know if I want to now.
Oh, we love your book recommendations, Kelly.
All right. Well, then I'm going to tell you another one. All right. My favorite zombie novel of the year would be This Is Not a Test by Courtney Summers. I talked about this one on the last podcast and talked about how it's a story about a girl who, when the zombie apocalypse hits, she doesn't want to live. But she's forced to be surrounded with 5 other students who are barricaded in their old high school. I could go on and on about how great the writing is, about how interesting it is to watch a character go from not wanting to live to finally finding a reason to want to live, even though there is no reason to live because the zombie apocalypse has broken out. But instead, I'm going to tell you the most important thing I learned while reading this book, and that is, during the zombie apocalypse, you can still have running water. That changes everything, my friends. It changes everything.
Well,
there was a tier rating on that, too.
Oh. Yes.
I don't know. Maybe 2? What's the scale?
I'm not sure, Kelly. I'm just not sure.
Was it a slow, sad cry, or were you sobbing?
It was a slow, sad cry.
I read that also and definitely enjoyed it. It was one of my picks for favorite books of the year. It was kind of interesting. When you have like someone who pretty much wants to die and now kind of just can't because, you know, the zombies are attacking, and part of the reason that she just can't say give in to the zombies is that there's other people dependent upon her to fight the zombie. So it's not, it wouldn't at that point just be suicide, but it would basically be suicide and possible responsible deaths of the other people around her. And it's also interesting because she comes from this abused background, and usually in zombie literature, everything is perfect until the zombies come. And here's someone who, like, you know, life was pretty screwed up before then too. So it's not like it was all puppies and roses and rainbows for her. And the other thing that I liked about that book was it also explored how boring the apocalypse can be. Because once they find the quasi-safe space where they can then kind of hang out, the adrenaline rush of running and fighting is gone, and now you're kind of stuck in this place, and what do you do? And what do you do with these group of people who basically the only thing you've had in common is you happen to be the lucky handful that didn't get eaten by the zombies.
And I should point out, I was looking at Twitter, and the novelist Lisa Gardner just tweeted out what her best novel of 2012 was.
And what was it?
The Fault in Our Stars.
You know, it's really nice when somebody who has gotten no recognition for any of their prior books gets so much glory heaped on them. Oh, did I say that out loud?
It's like seeing television commercials for James Patterson novels. It's like, yeah, because he needs the publicity.
Though, yeah. Interesting, I'm pretty sure that he was one of the first people to go on TV and advertise.
He was, yes.
Yes, and so it's like, and while I agree with you, like every time I'm like, dude, you're spending money, people are going to, like, you know, buy anyway, no matter what. Still, the fact that was kind of like how he, you know, he kind of like started that whole thing, like, wow, it's entirely possible that people who watch TV also read books. Go figure.
Say what you will about his books, the guy is a marketing genius.
Exactly. And anytime I see someone who's that good of a marketing genius, I think we could, like, sit up and pay attention because that something right's going on there.
Did you know that he came up with the I'm a Toys R Us kid campaign?
Okay, now you're just making fun of us.
No, that, really? That's what he used to be in marketing before. That was his campaign. That's how he got awesome. Famous in marketing. So he has a very famous marketing campaign behind him.
So he does know what he's talking about.
When it comes to that, yes. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, this is like the third interview where we've slammed James Patterson, so I should probably say
excellent. Excellent.
And I don't remember.
See, I have an easier time slamming someone like James Patterson just because he can laugh all the way to the bank. I would never slam somebody who it's like it's their first book out and they've still got five jobs to, you know, pay the rent and stuff like that because, you know, it's like he can slam the Queen of England.
I don't remember whose book was that. Was that Kelly's book?
That was mine.
Okay, so then it's my turn?
Yep.
Yeah.
So I'll go with The Raven Boys by Maggie Stiefvater. This is the first in a series, and I have to say I'm not sure if the next book is coming out in 2013 or 2014. And it is set in – I'm trying to think if it's set in Virginia or West Virginia. It's set in Virginia, and it's about a girl from a family of, like, psychics and mediums, and she doesn't really have quite any of the special powers they have. I think her special power is, like, really lame. Like, she makes other people's powers better. It's like, oh, yay, you can get far with that. And there's a – her family has always had a prediction about her that basically she would kill her true love with a kiss, which is like, yay, family. Thank you so much for sharing that. So she's kind of, basically it means that she's kind of like kept guys at arm's length because, you know, that's pretty much a bad prophecy to be living under. And despite that, she finds herself developing a friendship with this handful of guys from the local snooty prep school, and they are, in a way, the annoyingly arrogant, sure of themselves, rich prep school boys, but in the way aren't. They're led by this one character, Gansey, who has decided to dedicate himself to finding a lost Welsh king who he believes the king dates back from like the 15th century. And Gansey has gotten convinced that not only did this king get to the New World, that he is now buried someplace in Virginia, and he is dedicating himself to this cause of finding the tomb of the burial place of this lost king. And of course, is, you know, it's not just going to be finding him, that there's a prophecy that if you find him, you know, wonderful things happen. And so she gets hooked up into this crusade in this quest. And as I said, it's the first of four books, so there's things that are kind of left hanging because you've got you've got more books to continue the story. But it was I really liked it because it was a nice group of characters that were introduced, and I just love that type of history and mythology being used in a story.
Is it my turn?
It is your turn, Kelly. Go.
All right.
How many more categories do you have, Kelly?
I'm not going to count them. I'm just going to talk about them.
Okay, go.
All right. So my next category is my favorite William C. Morris finalist title. How do we like that category? Silence. I'm assuming you're so stunned by this that you have nothing to say.
I'm just waiting to hear what you say.
Oh. Well, my favorite would be Love and Other Perishable Items by Laura Buzo. And it's told through two perspectives. It's 15-year-old Amelia and 21-turning-22-year-old Chris. So in theory, if something like New Adult existed, which is a whole other podcast that would run 8 or 9 hours long, this would probably be a title that would fall into that category. However, it is firmly a young adult book. Amelia has just started a job at the local store, and she meets Chris, who has been working there as well. And the two of them have many conversations together. They talk about feminism and about the future, about the struggles of growing up. And it's really interesting to see it from Amelia's perspective, who is sort of head over heels in love with Chris, whereas Chris doesn't really reciprocate those feelings towards her because he's getting over heartbreak himself. What I really liked about this story is that it's so common. It's a story of average people, and I really appreciated that Buzo didn't feel the need to throw in something really spectacular to make this contemporary story work. It's just two people growing up and sort of working through the challenges of the tension in their lives.
It's funny. I just finished reading this morning while I was getting the oil changed in my on my car, and it is a very good book. I enjoyed it. I also enjoyed that the two characters meet when they're both working. They both have part-time jobs at the same food store. And it's also an interesting look at class and culture. And I'm not sure how much of it is because of it. I'm trying to figure out what is because it's Australian or not. In some ways, there are things that I thought were very reminded me more of kids growing up more like 15 or 20 years ago because Amelia's parents are so not helicopter parents. Her parents are together. They are married. They are both professionals, but they are professionals in careers where they're not making a lot of money. So they're pretty much overworked, overtired. Amelia's working about 19 hours a week, and she's like walking 20 minutes to the bus stop. She's like got these multiple bus rides that she does to get to home, to get to work, like a certain level of autonomy that you don't always see in a book about someone who is 14, 15 years old. She, at the supermarket, she's making friends who are older than she is. As Kelly points out, the person she gets the crush on is about 6-7 years older than she is. She's going to their parties, and her parents are sort of like, oh, you're going out with friends, and that's the end. There is no, we're driving you, what's the name of the parents, who are you going with, any of that type of thing that you would kind of expect more to see in this day and age. And so again, I'm trying to sort out whether that's an American versus Australian thing, whether it's a reflection of how overworked her parents are, but whatever it is, it's sort of nice to see that being portrayed in a book. And it's also nice to see this 6 or 7 year difference between the two of them. And the guy, basically his fault is that he's a good moral character. He's not about to go all skeevy after a 15-year-old just because she thinks, you know, the moon rises and sets on him.
I like how the last two books have been my books, but yet you have talked about them longer than I have.
You've got like a countdown going on? I thought we were going to have conversation. You know, to show that we really are doing this all at the same time. It's not just you talking, me talking, and then Steve making it sound like we talk to each other.
How old are you, Liz?
That's what we did last time, right? You guys weren't even on the call together.
As a matter of fact, I'm not even talking to either of you right now. It's just me talking to myself and the cats.
I asked a question. I didn't get an answer.
What?
How old are you, Liz?
Older than you. So my next book I'm going to pick is The Opposite of Hallelujah by...
pick that one.
What?
I was going to pick that one.
So sad. So sad for you.
What's your category for that one, Kelly?
Favorite underappreciated novel of the year. But I'll let
you go first, though.
The Opposite of Hallelujah by Anna Jarzab is about two sisters, Caroline and Hannah, and there's about a good 8 to 10 years between them, and the distance is made more that Hannah left home about 8 years ago, and so it's 8 years later, and her sister, Caroline, is about 16 now, and Hannah has come home. And the reason Hannah left home is a little bit unique. She went and she decided to follow a religious life, and she joined a convent, and not just any convent, but one of the types of orders where you basically withdraw from the world, where you do not get, you're not out interacting with other people, you don't get visits from the family, the communications you have are very limited. So that's basically where Hannah's been living for 8 years. And Caroline's not done a very good job dealing with it. I would also add, as the book goes on, probably because her parents also haven't done a good job of reconciling themselves to what Hannah has done. And pretty much Hannah now, after 8 years of this lifestyle, pretty much has decided that's not how she's going to continue her life, and she comes home. But when she comes home, it's clear that there's other things going on with her. So you've got all these different things going on, like, why did Hannah go to join the convent? Why has she come home? Now that she's home, what is she going to do with her life? And Caroline, meanwhile, has to adjust from being, in a way, a very spoiled only child, because she was such the center of her parents' attention when it was just her at home, to now having someone else that she has to share her parents and her life with. I mean, Caroline was to the point where she basically didn't even tell people that she had a sister, and at times even lied about what had happened with her sister. So it's a really interesting look at siblings, at choices, and also at religion, because for whatever is going on with Hannah and later Caroline, the treatment of organized religion and religious belief is always treated with a lot of respect, which I really appreciate seeing in a teen book.
All of that, and I'll add to what I liked about the book was how Carol wasn't always the most likable character, but yet as a reader, you sympathized with her a lot because you understood exactly what she was going through and how tough it was to go from being sort of the only child and the center of attention to now having to share that with this person who's pretty much a foreign person to her, and who herself is dealing with so many issues that she's just weird and aloof. And I appreciated that it wasn't easy to like her, but at the same time, you did like her because you just got what she was going through.
Kelly, do you have another book for us?
I do. I think I'm going to do my favorite multiple point of view book this year, and that would be Siobhan Vivian's The List, which came out early in 2012, and it follows eight girls. So it's got eight different voices, and it's told from third person. And the story follows that every year at Mount Washington High School, a list is posted during homecoming week that lists the prettiest girl and the ugliest girl in each grade level. So the prettiest and ugliest freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior. And in this particular year, each of the girls who are named to the list is followed during the week and what making that list has done to them during school. So what it does is it attempts to look at what it feels like to be listed as the prettiest girl or the ugliest girl. And besides sort of dismantling the beauty myth in it, it really gives perspective on whether or not labels mean anything at all. It really gives depth into whether that label can impact you on a great level, or if it's just something that you can ignore. It's sort of a modern take on the chocolate war, if that gives any further indication into the story.
Okay.
Did you read that one, Liz?
I read that one. I've also never read the chocolate war. So, or if I did, I really don't really remember doing so. I liked it. It was definitely, the list was disturbing just because of the dynamics of how people treat each other and the way that they used words and labels to try to control other people. It was not what I would call a pleasant read because of just how mean and unkind so many people were being on so many levels. Also, how accepted this was within the school's culture, because this list had been going on for like years and years and years. And it was one of those things where supposedly all the teens know about it, yet none of the teachers do. And none of the teachers then really do anything about it. So that was also disturbing too.
All right. Let's, you guys can do one more book. I know you have a lot more. You probably have a lot more categories, Kelly, but
I don't have that many more, but one more is fine.
Well, we're just...
Okay. So my last one then will be The Fitzosbornes at War by Michelle Cooper. This is the last in her series about the Fitzosbornes that began with A Brief History of Montmorency and then was Fitzosbornes in Exile and The Fitzosbornes at War. And the short version is it is an excellent look at England during World War II, told from the point of view of the people who were at the home front, the women and the war effort and what they were involved with and doing and living with bomb attacks and wanting to be involved but being limited to what they could do on account of the fact of being female. And just interesting, and the slightly longer one is the whole theme through this series is that this is a royal family from a small made up island. So at the same time, all this very factually correct stuff about World War II is happening. It's through the background of a small independent country trying to continue their independence or regain independence during the time period.
Kelly.
Your turn.
Oh, okay, rather than give a book talk, I'm just going to read the remaining categories and what books I put in there, since there's only a couple.
So, in other words, she's cheating. She's being a cheating cheater from Cheatersville.
I really
remember this, Kelly.
Whatever.
This
you know
will have her revenge.
Anyway. All right.
Kelly.
Listen, I'm just really proud of my categorization, so we're going to go with it. All right, so my favorite book about a mental illness would be Amy Reid's Crazy, and that looks at bipolar disorder. My favorite military-themed title this year would be Something Like Normal by Trish Dohler. My favorite romance this year was The Statistical Probability of Love at First Sight by Jennifer E. Smith. My favorite bullying book, if you could have such a thing, would be Butter by Erin Jade Lang. My most WTF-worthy book would be Children and the Wolves by Adam Rapp. My favorite literary and also favorite translated work this year would be The Storyteller by Antonia Macaulis, I think is how you say her name. My favorite crazy book would be 172 Hours on the Moon by Johanna Harstead. And then this is my favorite category. My favorite depiction of MRSA this year was Catch and Release by Blythe Wolston.
Well, I would say that for me, The Statistical Probability of Love at First Sight would be my favorite book that it appears Sears ripped off to do a commercial of. Which, if you've read the book and you've watched the Sears commercial about the couple in the airport, you'll know what I'm talking about.
I don't think I've seen that commercial, but I'm going to have to pay attention now.
Yeah, I haven't either.
Oh, I'll send – I will – I'm finding the link and posting it on Twitter. Don't worry. Yeah. You have not seen the Sears commercial?
I have a DVR, I have a DVR, so I don't know what these commercial things are. So
I usually read commercials, so.
All right. I'm seeing if I can get it for you because it pretends to be a fake movie trailer connecting flights about a couple who meet at the airport and they're both like delayed. I might have seen that. Yeah, and probably the first five times you saw it and you weren't paying attention that you thought it really was a trailer for a movie, because it's not until the very end that you're like, this is about appliances?
Sears.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Okay, so do you guys have things that are coming out this next year that you're looking forward to?
I do.
Maybe things that you have arcs of?
Maybe things that I've already read arcs of? Does that work?
Perhaps.
All right. Do you want to go first, Liz, or can I go?
You go first.
All right. Did you like how I said that? Like, I offered it to you, but really, I wanted to go first.
That's okay. And you know what? You, I'm sure, have a longer list than I do, so you go first.
That's probably right. A good bet. So.
All right. So the first one on my list is 17 and Gone by Nova Ranzuma. And I've already read this one, and I can't talk too much about it without giving away what's going on. But Lauren, the main character, has been visited by these girls who have gone missing when they've turned 17 years old. And they've all gone missing for different reasons, and they've all kind of visited her for her help and to sort of warn her that as she is about to approach her 17th birthday, she might find herself missing too. It's creepy, but the writing is so absorbing that you fall into the story, and it's easy to sort of, I don't want to say be tricked, but be led astray in what's really going on in the story. I kind of spoiled myself on what was going on beforehand, but I really appreciated seeing how she got to that point, even though I knew what was going to be the final unravel, the end. I recently read Absent by Katie Williams, and this is a ghost story about a girl who she had fallen off the edge of her high school on the roof. Her science class is up there doing the infamous egg drop. But after she dies, she's sitting in this therapy session with the rest of people who are mourning her loss, people who are mourning the loss of somebody else who had died that year. And the main character comes to see that people don't think she fell off the roof. They think she jumped off the roof. So the whole story follows as she tries to figure out whether she fell or she jumped and what the implications of either outcome is and why and how that impacts her as a ghost now. It's really creepy. But it's also a really short book. It's under 200 pages, but it packs so much into it. The next one will be Eleanor and Park, which is a romance, and it's set in the 1980s. About a girl who is new at school who sits next to Park on the bus. He's not interested in her. She doesn't want to be seen with him. But over the course of the novel, the two of them, of course, start seeing each other, and they come to learn that there's a lot more to each other than is on the surface. It was a really sweet novel, but it was a hard-earned sort of sweetness. It wasn't at all kind of candy sweet as a romance. I've got two more. Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay. Daisy Whitney has a new book coming out in May called When You Were Here, and it follows Danny, who has just graduated high school. His father died a few years ago, and his mom died just a few months ago. And it was his mom's dying wish to see him graduate before cancer finally took her, but she died before that happened. And Danny hadn't given himself opportunity to grieve the loss of his mom because he wanted to finish school so badly. And when he gets up on stage at his graduation to give valedictorian speech, that's when the grief kind of hits him. And he realizes that he has to figure out where to go from here. He has to figure out how he can grieve the loss of his mom, but also how he's going to deal with the now big grown-up questions in front of him. Does he go to college? Does he sell the house? What does he do? And he takes this as an opportunity to go to the family's vacation house in Japan and sort of sort things out. Meanwhile, during the story, his girlfriend, who he had been really in love with, broke up with him a few months ago, and he couldn't figure out why she suddenly left him and why she wouldn't communicate with him. But when he's in Japan and sorting through his mom's life there and sorting through what it is he wants to do in the future, he comes to figure out what it is that had caused Holland to leave him. And it was a really... What?
Are you going to tell us what caused her to leave him?
No, because it's a big reveal in the story. And no, a really spoilers. Good one.
Man, that's no fun.
I'll tell
now you'll
you
have
later.
To read it.
And then the last book I'm going to talk about is The Reese Malcolm List by Amy Spalding. And it's a debut novel, and it comes out in a month or so, a little less than a month. It follows this girl named Devin, who has been living with her dad forever. Her parents are divorced. But when her dad dies, she has to go live with the infamous Reese Malcolm, who is her mother. She knows nothing about Reese Malcolm except that she's a well-renowned author. That's all she knows about her. And so when she's tossed into this new life in Los Angeles, she not only has to adjust to a new school, and she's going to a performing arts school now rather than local high school, she's competing against, you know, these students who have grown up in performing arts high schools their whole life. But more than that, she has to figure out who her mom is, and doing so isn't easy. Her mom's not an easy nut to crack at all. And while it sounds like it could be the sort of story that goes down the grief road that could be kind of sad, it's actually a really charming and delightful read. There's a lot of musical theater involved in it, and it's really sort of a rewarding family story, and it's a really non-traditional family as well. And those are my picks for 2013 so far.
Cool. Liz, do you have some?
I am already so behind that it's like, wait a minute, how can it be January 7th and I'm behind? Part of it is, as I said, like for the past 6 weeks, I've been catching up on the Morris and the nonfiction and stuff like that. So my list is definitely shorter and less exhaustive or researched or any of that. I'm, as I said earlier, I mentioned a couple of the books earlier that I'm looking forward to. The sequel to the I Hunt Killers, the Son of the Serial Killer one. The third book in the Kiki Strike series, and part of the reason, as I mentioned earlier, that I'm excited about that is because I think it'll bring Kiki Strike to more readers, considering the other books in the series came out in, I think it was 2006 and 2007. Quintana of Charon by Melina Marchetta, I'm very excited about because it wraps up that trilogy. And then what else I've read that I really liked was Paper Valentine by Brenna Yovanoff, which is also a mystery, but it's a mystery ghost story where the main character begins looking into the murders of young girls in her hometown. And at the same time, she's being haunted by the ghost of a friend of hers, of her best friend. And what's interesting is when I first began reading the book, I assumed, as I think almost anyone would, that, oh, the ghost of her friend was someone who was also murdered because she's looking into these murders. And what it really is that her friend died from complications from anorexia. So it's an interesting look at anorexia that's not, you know, sort of like how the friends and family get by afterwards, but really wrapped into this murder mystery.
Well, thank you guys again for another fantastic in-depth discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And I'm sure we'll do it again in the future.
Yay!
Yay!
I'll talk to you guys later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I am Christy Chadwick. I am the library director at the Emily Williston Memorial Library in East Hampton, Massachusetts. And my favorite books are mostly science fiction and fantasy because that's what I tend to read. But I've also got a couple previews for 2013, which run into the mystery genre, too. So
exciting.
It was a really good year for science fiction and fantasy. I think 2012 was. There was a lot of great authors. I mean, top of my list was probably Jim Butcher's latest one, Cold Days. Mm-hmm. Harry Dresden, wizard and PI extraordinaire. He's definitely back with a vengeance in this book. And, you know, he's still suffering from guilt overload from his previous books and dealing with the fallout of coming back from the dead. Hopefully people have read Ghost Story already since I'm talking
spoiler.
About this. Spoiler!
Yeah, spoiler.
should have said spoiler first, but everyone in the books has an opinion about Harry coming back from the dead, and they're not always good ones. And, of course, Butcher sets up a perfect ending. I'm using sarcasm font with that, as usual, and, you know, it just makes you thrilled for the next book coming.
Cliffhanger.
Yeah, cliffhangers. Always cliffhangers. A couple debut authors this year. I had Tina Connolly with Iron Skin. It's basically been touted as a steampunk Jane Eyre, and it has to do with the Fae. about a war where the main character, Jane Elliott, she has to wear an iron mask because she's a victim of some of the war's remnants and dealing with becoming a governess for another special child and falling in love with the girl's father. But he actually has some secrets that come to light at the end of the book, which set up perfectly for the second one that'll be coming too.
Books tend to do that, don't they?
They do. Jocelyn Drake, she's not a debut author. She's someone I've been following for a while, but she has a new series that just started called The Asylum Tales. First book in it is Angel's Ink. Tattoos. I am a tattooed librarian, so of course that was a big draw for me. And you've got a tattooer who actually dabbles a little bit in being a sorcerer also. I may be using the wrong term with sorcerer, but he puts magic into his tattoos, which is not necessarily what he should be doing. And him and his co-workers are trying to fly under the radar, but of course that never succeeds. So it's great urban fantasy, and I definitely recommend Jocelyn Drake that and her previous Dark Days series.
And don't put magic in your tattoos.
And don't put magic in your tattoos. Always a good idea.
Listen, kids.
Along that line, Shauna Maguire. Love, love, total fangirl squee over Shauna Maguire, her series. She's got October Day, who is a changeling fae, but she's had to make a lot of decisions through the past few books, and now she's actually full-blood fae. But she does investigations. She's really, really great. And her book this year was Ashes of Honor. And I'm definitely giving a shout-out for her upcoming titles in 2013. Toby's next adventure will be in September, which chimes at midnight. But Maguire also debuted a new series this year called the Encrypted series, which is kind of a investigation of... She's a ballroom dancer, an investigator, and dealing with a family who has kind of investigated all of these supernatural beings through the years. And but the first book of that is Discount Armageddon, which was really fun. And then the next book is coming out this year, and that's Midnight Blue Light Special.
Jeez. Are you shouting out to the other part of her?
Oh, yes. Mira Grant. She... I definitely should do that. Shauna Maguire also wrote under the name Mira Grant. She did a trilogy called the Newsflesh Trilogy. Blackout was the last of that series that came out this year, but previous to that was Feed and Deadline. It is zombie stories. Now, some people think zombie stories are kind of on their way out, but this one had politics, it had news blogging, it had family dynamics, plus, you know, zombies eating people. So it was really gritty, really intense, and all three books, the day that I got them, I read them, I whined about it until I could get the next one, and then, of course, I cried at the end of every book. So... But it was amazing. It was great. And to get that really kind of, it's even beyond urban fantasy because it has all of that news and blogging and politics. And it just kind of takes it a little bit beyond what you would think for traditional urban fantasy these days.
So you cried in a good way.
I cried in a good way. Yes. I cried in shock and awe and sadness and all of the above.
And not having the next book.
And not having the next book in my hands and having to wait another year. But, you know, I do that with lots of series. So those are kind of my tops, really, for 2012 with a little bit of 2013. One other shout out that I do want to give for 2013. Mm-hmm. I actually got an ARC for an upcoming Library Journal review that I did coming up in March. It's called Green Light for Murder by Haywood Gould. He is a writer and also a screenwriter too. And you definitely see a lot of that kind of movie session in it. In fact, it's not my usual type of mystery, but it's the story of a director who decides to make his ultimate movie about a psychotic producer who goes and kills everybody who wronged him through the years. The problem is that, of course, you know, the movie is all in his head and he's actually doing all of this himself. So it's just crazy, but it's the pace and the characters, they all blew me right out of the water. And I'm just really excited to see where it goes next.
It's funny, you can tell sometimes when people are come from screenwriting, like with Ready Player One as well.
Yes.
You could tell that was very movie-like, too. You could tell he was a screenwriter.
Yeah, the pacing of that sort of stuff. And I know Dick Wolf's got his latest one out, just came out, I think, this past week. So the way that the writers who come from that screenwriting background just have a really intense way of writing and a great pace that you really only used to see in the movies.
Yeah, I'm a big Law and Order nerd, so I think I have to read that Dick Wolf book.
Well, that's what I got. Oh. I'm going to turn it over to Anna.
Oh, goody. All right, my name is Anna Mickelson. I work at the Springfield City Library in Springfield, Massachusetts. You can find me online at Helga Grace on Twitter and most other places. And I broke my list up into my favorites of each genre that I read regularly, which is, you know, some overlap. But we don't actually read the same things in the same genre, so... So my favorite fantasy this year was The Blinding Knife by Brent Weeks. It's the second book in the Lightbringer trilogy. And everyone I know who has read the book has finished it and been like, ah!
Was that a good scream or a bad scream?
Scream and a bad scream. Like, I can't believe he did that, and it's going to take him 2 years to write the next one. Help. Kind of scream. But it's a really complex series. The magic system is something that I think a fantasy fan is either going to like or hate. So it's all based on color and light. And if someone was a fan of Brandon Sanderson, they would definitely like this book, I think. But there's just a wide cast of characters and convincing, you know, anti-hero and hero relationship. And I'm just waiting impatiently for the last one in the trilogy. Let's see what's next on my list.
There's lots of waiting impatiently.
Yes, well, that is the life of a reader, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite YA book that I read this year was called The Miseducation of Cameron Post by Emily Danforth. And it's a story about a girl who's growing up in a small Montana town. And she... Get that cat down from there! We have to lock the cats out now.
That's a common thing heard in librarian households.
Yeah. she discovers that she likes girls more than she likes boys at the same time that her parents are getting killed in an accident. So she has a feeling of guilt that she carries with her. Like somehow she might have caused this because she's like 13 years old. And then the narrative is really kind of slowly paced and goes through several relationships that she has as she's sort of coming to terms with her past and her parents. And it's just a really moving book. It goes a little bit. She gets shipped away to a de-gang facility. So it goes into that a little bit, but that's not described as like a horror place. It's just sort of a place where people are misguided and they think maybe they can change what's going on. So overall, I really enjoyed that whole story. It was the best YA book I read this year, and the best lesbian-oriented fiction I read also. And I read a lot of that. So
yes, you do.
Along those lines, my favorite romance this year was by Sherry Thomas. It's called Ravishing the Heiress, which you just have to ignore the titles of these.
That's the plot of most romances anyway.
I was going to say, that's the plot and the title of most romances, I think.
It's the second book in a a trilogy called the Fitzhugh Trilogy. It's set in like late 1800s period. And anyone who likes historical romance, I would totally recommend any Sherry Thomas book. But this one in particular caught my attention. You've got a guy who inherits an estate that's totally debt-ridden. And then he has to marry... He's in love with someone else, but he has to marry this girl for the, you know, for the solvency of his estate. And they make a pact that, you know, they'll produce an heir, and then he can go off and be with the woman that he loves in, I think, 11 years, some arbitrary amount of time. So then the story picks up, you know, 11 years later when they have to get down to heir producing. And basically they become best friends, and they share everything. And, you know, his wife has been in love with him for, you know, since they initially met in the first place, but he still thinks he loves this other lady. So anyway, it's a really good character study of their relationship. And of course, there's also, you know, romance stuff.
Is there some ravishing going on?
There is some ravishing, but it's sort of low key in the end because they actually already know each other all, you know, completely. So
low key ravishing.
Yeah, ravishing. And then my favorite sci-fi was, well, if anyone is a Lois McMaster Pujold fan, this would probably be their favorite because it's the latest in the Vorkosigan saga called Captain Vorpatrol's Alliance. And it tells the story of his cousin Ivan, who, you know, there have been, I don't know how many books, like a dozen books in the series before this. Or books and short stories. And, you know, after a while you start to think, but what about Ivan? When does he get to have his own story? And when does he get to find someone to be with? And this is totally everything you would want out of that. So it just made me happy. I got an advanced copy and through the power of Twitter. And I read it in about a day. And then I put it on to the next person. On the list, and made me extremely happy. I will read it again.
Yeah, I've heard good things about her series, but I've never actually read that one. Is that one that you need to start at the beginning?
You don't necessarily need to start at the beginning. There are actually a couple of beginnings that you can start at. You can start with his parents in Cordelia's honor, or you could start with him. Sort of, I think the first book starts out with him graduating from military school and immediately breaking both of his legs trying to do something that he can't do. So you can start here and there. She sort of incorporates all kinds of different genres. So it's a little sci-fi, a little mystery, a little romance, some military stuff. Highly recommend all of them. I probably wouldn't start at Captain Vorpatrol's Alliance because you won't feel the sense of squee as much if you have encountered Ivan in all of his glory before. He's usually a sort of bored, womanizing person who gets caught up in everything. And my other pick is hard to categorize. It's The Rook by Daniel O'Malley. It's set in Britain where a woman wakes up, I think in a park, and she starts getting letters from herself. She wakes up without remembering anything at all. And the letters start out by saying, like, if you don't have anything to do with anything, like, here's money, you're going to go, like, to the Virgin Islands and have a new life. Or, you know, if you're interested in knowing what's going on, like, try this letter, but then you're going to be committed. So it turns out that she is an operative for this supernatural agency in Britain, and she has actual paranormal powers, and sort of get introduced to all of her annoying coworkers. And like, there's one that has four bodies, any of which can be activated at the same time, and they go around dealing with crises, and you realize that the person she was before she lost her memory was sort of shy and unassuming and let everyone stomp all over her, but the person she's becoming now is really learning to use her powers and coming into herself. So it's pretty cool to watch her develop. And I think it's the first of a projected series. So I'm looking forward to reading more about it.
So that one doesn't doesn't end in the cliffhanger, though, I guess.
It's not a cliffhanger, but I think what I've seen is that he's working on the next one. So he's Australian, I believe. But it's got that British sense of, you know, humor where if you like Britain-oriented things, you'll probably gonna like it, especially if you're into any kind of speculative fiction.
And do you have anything that's coming out in 2013 that you're looking forward to?
Yes! tomorrow.
Tomorrow!
In 1990, Robert Jordan came out with his first book, The Eye of the World, and some of us started reading that series and acquiring the books every few years in hardback form. And then he died several years ago and without finishing the series. And Brandon Sanderson was tapped to finish it for him and has been working on the last three books. The last of the books, all of the books, is coming out tomorrow. I will be reading it. And I've been looking forward to it, well, not since 1990, but since about 1999, when it became clear that the series was going to be really, really long and never end.
In January 8th.
Tomorrow, January 8th, Tuesday. Although Christy has held a copy in her hands and didn't bring it to me.
Oh.
Street dates and stuff. I was a bookseller a dozen years before I was a librarian.
I would have come and sat in your library. and the other one I'm looking forward to is Ever After by Kim Harrison. It's the latest in the Hollow series, which I always enjoy, and I know that it's going to be good. I think that's coming out this month, too.
Yeah, that's coming out at the end of this month.
But I'm sure I'm going to find, you know, about 100 other books that I want to read this year.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Naomi Novik's coming out.
You're right. Yeah, that too. Yes. And I do want to mention a little nonfiction since neither of us have.
Sure, go for it.
But I think both of us have on our list Wild by Cheryl Strayed as an excellent nonfiction pick. Memoir of her hike on the
Pacific Coast Trail. It's just one of those books where, you know, she went with a purpose and her writing and her journey struck a chord inside. And when you have a book like that, that can do that to you and make you feel like you are walking with her.
And her giant backpack.
It's one of things that even though you don't want to jump on the bandwagon of everyone loving it, you have to love it.
That was the one that was Oprah's new book club thing. Is that right?
But don't hold that against it.
No, don't.
I'm just trying to remember if I'm thinking of the right books.
Yeah, that's the right one.
Yeah.
It has a big boot on the front of it.
All right. Christy and Anna, thank you so much for talking to me and giving us your best list. And I think there's lots of good things to read now because I haven't read any of those. So,
excellent. Go read Miles and The Rook and read them all.
Yes, definitely.
I know I have whole long series to catch up on now, too.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yes. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Hi, I'm Sarah Stotz-Kortz. I write for the Reader's Advisor online blog. That's published by ABC Clio. And I'm also online at citizenreader.com. And I want to say thanks to you and to Steve for having me today. We're here to talk about great nonfiction of 2012. And it's funny because when I started the year, I looked at the forthcoming books and honestly, I thought it was going to be kind of a stinker year for nonfiction. And I finished it up feeling that way. But when I looked back on things I'd read, I realized it was actually a pretty good year for nonfiction. I found a lot of fun titles. I'll start with just a few of my favorites. Very subjective list, of course.
Of course.
aren't they all? The first one I want to talk about is an investigative or journalistic book. It's called Hidden America by Jeannie Marie Laskus. Not quite sure I'm saying her name right. She's written a few other books, a couple memoirs, and she also writes the advice column for Reader's Digest. And this is a book where she goes and she examines what she calls the jobs that nobody wants to think about. So she opens the book with a chapter where she goes into a coal mine with the coal miners, and it's It's unbelievable. Blew my mind. And later on in the book, she's an oil rig in Alaska. Same story. To hear about these jobs that people do, how they live, Alaska in particular, for months in darkness at a time, they just don't leave their compound while they work on their rig. It's a great book. She looks at a lot of different jobs. I actually was talking to a guy at the gas station who the owner was helping me with the pump, and he was said a lot of people have been complaining about gas. And I said, well, actually, it should probably cost more. You should read this book about the oil rigs. And that's the first time I can honestly say that's the first time I've suggested a book to my local gas station owner. So it's definitely a title that stood out. For a little something different, the next book I want to talk about, this one actually got a lot of good press this year. Some of the books I'm going to talk about you didn't hear about a whole lot, but this was a big title. Every Love Story is a Ghost Story by D.T. Max. And that is a literary biography of David Foster Wallace, very famous, of course, postmodern literature writer who tragically killed himself, suffered from depression for many years. And I want to stress the fact that this is a literary biography. I read it because I find David Foster Wallace very interesting. I wanted to know more about him personally. And it didn't disappoint on that level, but it's definitely not like a dishy celebrity story. He looks at how David Foster Wallace created fiction, how seriously he took it, how it informed his whole life. And it just, it read really quickly for an in-depth biography. I really enjoyed it. And I don't think you have to be a Wallace fan. I can't read Wallace's fiction. I read and enjoy his nonfiction, but I've never made it through any of his novels or short stories. I don't think I've ever made it through a short story, and I still love this biography.
Good.
Yeah. So really, anybody who's into literature and authors, I think, might enjoy the tech, the nuts and bolts aspect of that story. The third one, I'm aware, is a tough sell. This is a graphic novel called My Friend Dahmer, and it was by Dirk Backderf. I think that's how you say his name. Dirk Backderf actually went to high school with Jeffrey Dahmer, who was as you may or may not know, an infamous serial killer, who operated right here in Wisconsin, where I am in Milwaukee, tragically killed many men before he was caught and stopped. But this is a boy who knew, or a man now, but a boy then who knew Dahmer in high school, and he warns you in the beginning of the book not to feel sorry for Dahmer because he went on to do horrible things, of course. But when you're reading it, you actually do start to feel, it's just such a confluence of bad things that went wrong in this life and then in other people's lives. You wouldn't believe it. And there's enough other details in the book. At one point, they go on a field trip to Washington, D.C., and Dahmer talks his way into the office of a very high-up political politician. You're just going to have to read the book to find out who the politician was. This would be in the late, I forget, 80s or 80s. Yeah, intrigue. Like, you need intrigue with a Dahmer story. But it's just a completely, and the graphic novel format really makes it something different. I recommended it to my brother because we had both read Lionel Dahmer's memoir, a really sad book of where he thought he had gone wrong and just trying to make sense of what his son had done. So when my brother was blown away by that one, I thought, oh, he's got to try this one too. So My Friend Dahmer by Dirk Backderf. And now I want you to go 180 degrees. Completely. This is a little book I read just a couple of weeks ago. It's called Always Put in a Recipe by Evelyn Berkby. It's this little University of Iowa Press book, and it's a collection of essays and newspaper articles that this Evelyn Berkby wrote from the late 1940s up through, I think, 2011. She was known as the favorite housewife in Iowa, so she would write these columns for newspapers that were just very down-home. You would call them gentle if you have readers who like gentle fiction or nonfiction. This is as gentle as it gets, pretty much, although sad things happen in it. I was blown away by this one because I have a little boy, and sometimes it's hard to keep him as healthy as you want. But at one point, she talks about living in rented farmhouses in 1950s Iowa, where wind would come up through the floorboards. So she would try to, you know, get the kids in the playpen with some blankets around it to try to keep them warm, and they battled croup. And I needed the perspective. And I'm not usually a gentle reader, and sometimes, you know, this woman is very stiff upper lip and a very kind, can do sort of way. Normally I'm not in for that at all, but it was a really enlightening read and I enjoyed it. Just a couple more I can cover pretty quickly. This one is titled George Harrison, Living in the Material World, and it's by George Harrison, the Beatle. I'm not sure why it didn't get more press or why it didn't show up on any list that I could find, maybe because it was published earlier in the year. It's gorgeous. It's this big illustrated book with a lot of Harrison's photography, so you get these wonderful photos from the early days of the Beatles when they were playing small clubs in London, and then you also get kind of his progression through spirituality, his trips to India, his charity work, his family photos, but just the insight into this man and his love for music and how he met the other Beatles, the combination of the photography and the music story, I really enjoyed. And I had no particular love for George Harrison before this. I'm not a huge Beatles maniac. I think I just brought it home because the cover, if you look at the cover of it, it's so beautiful. And I ended up having to listen to a lot of George Harrison's music afterwards. So that was a nice bonus. And the last one I'm going to talk about that I really enjoyed is a little book called Read This, Handpicked Favorites from America's Indie Bookstores. It's an edited collection, but it's introduced by Ann Patchett, who, in addition to being a novelist, also owns an independent bookstore. It's this list. It's this book of lists from independent booksellers, like 25 to 50 books that they want you to read. And it's refreshing, especially when you come from the library world. I think we often feel like we can't recommend, we can't push our thoughts. We just suggest. We kind of float ideas, and I think sometimes we do ourselves a disservice. Yes. Because when you read these indie booksellers, they love these books, and it's not just because they love it and they're thinking about themselves. It's because they're thinking about you as a reader, and they want you to love these books too. And there's other tidbits about the books and books they might have enjoyed and little paragraphs about their bookstores, so it makes you want to travel as well. And there's very little duplication on any of the lists. It's just a wonderful, fun, inspiring. I read it before bed, like for the past month, and it was just inspiring to hear people and their love for these books.
Yeah, that's one of the best parts about Reader's Advisory is passing on your passion for books to other people. So.
Exactly, and I think we tend to look at it, like I said, I got so frustrated with the norm of, you know, you can't, it's not about you, it's about the reader, don't bring any of your opinions. And I think you can bring your opinions. I think that's the only way you can help another reader get to where they want to be. And that's the business we're in. I don't think we're as far removed from indie booksellers as we think. So it was just nice to see it in this context. As far as should reads, there were a couple of books I didn't get to and I thought I should have. There was a memoir called Wild by Cheryl Strayed, of course, that's been everywhere. So I want to read that one still. Also, Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo, a travel book that appeared on all the best of lists. And there was one last little book called Reinventing Bach by Paul Ely. And that's kind of a new look at Bach and his music. And I just mentioned that one because Ely's a very interesting writer. I like him a lot. And it's a new look at Bach and his music and what it's meant to the world. One book that underwhelmed me this year was Quiet by Susan Cain. And I only mention that because it's, you know, kind of catnip to
right, yes.
people and librarians because, you know, the idea is introverts are great and are underappreciated. And who doesn't love that idea? But I found it kind of dry. I've had it home 3 times now, the book, and I can't get past the first chapter. So that was one I thought was overrated.
Yeah, it felt to me like it was a good long magazine piece that was maybe stretched out into a book. Like
yeah.
there's a good like quarter to it, but I've never finished it either. I've had it a couple times too and tried to.
Okay, well, that makes me feel better because every time I check it out, everybody who checks it out to me says, oh, I've been wanting to read this.
Yeah.
And then I back in and they're like, how was it? And I'm like, I still haven't gotten through it.
Yeah, no, that's just sort of the feeling that I got, that it wasn't enough. It's just too much. It's too long for the subject matter. It's going in depth in something that doesn't have that much depth. I guess.
Yes.
I don't know.
Exactly. Because the intro alone was like 20 pages. And I'm not kidding. The idea is introverts are wonderful. I mean, there's just not that. I don't know how you spin that into 20 and then 200 pages. That's one I wonder how many people on the best of lists actually read, or if it just kind of took on a life of its own. That's maybe not a good supposing, but that's just what I wonder. A few titles to look forward to. There's a couple in January in particular, and this list is even more subjective. These are just ones that really stood out to me. There's one called American Isis by Carl Rawlinson, and this is a biography, a new biography of Sylvia Plath. And I mention it because it's the first one to make use of Ted Hughes' archives. And Ted Hughes, of course, was her husband at the time separated. I think they were when she killed herself. So it's just, I think it will be a new look at her life. Could be interesting. Another one in January is called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. That's by an author named Lawrence Wright. And Lawrence Wright is sometimes called one of the new nonfiction writers or creative nonfiction writers. He's hard to classify, but he's always very, very interesting. And Scientology is not something I'm interested in at all, but I might get this title just because Lawrence Wright does such interesting things. And, of course, it's kind of a hot topic right now if you follow OMG Yahoo, of course, less as I do, which is embarrassing but true. last year, you know, you couldn't get away from the Tom Cruise, Katie Holmes headlines, so Scientology. Right. He might have a pit with this one. I think it's time for him, actually. In February, there's two titles coming out again that are particularly interesting to me, and I hope to you. My Brother's Book by Maurice Sendak. I think it actually is about his brother. I don't know too much about it, but anything by Maurice Sendak is noteworthy. And there's a book coming out called Detroit by a journalist named Charlie LaDuff. He's just takes a look at Detroit, and for some reason, I find Detroit very interesting, how it's progressing and as an urban setting. And he'll take a more in-depth look at it. He wrote something, I think, called Us Guys, and that was like a journey around America talking just to guys to see what the picture of manhood was in America. It was an interesting book. In March, there's something out called Gun Guys. That's by Dan Baum, and that's an investigation of gun culture. Again, a very timely, if sad, topic right now. Maybe by March, we'll be ready for that. I don't know.
Right.
But maybe not. Dan Baum is an interesting article writer, too. I think he writes for The New Yorker. He wrote an earlier book about New Orleans and living there. In April, there's a new David Sedaris title out. I should have looked it up. I forget the title of that. It's something like Exploring Diabetes with Owls. It's a very strange title, but it's always nice to know when a new David Sedaris title is coming out because people ask for him, of course. That's in April. And the last shout-out I want to give is to an author named Stacey Horn. She's written memoir and also a true crime book. She wrote a memoir called Waiting for My Cats to Die that was quite interesting. And she also wrote a true crime book called The Restless Sleep about New York City's cold case squad, which is probably bar none the best true crime, most sympathetic true crime book I've ever read. She's a vigorous author, and by that I mean she does all her own fact-checking. She's out in New York. I speak with her periodically, not getting rich, so that's why I kind of have an idea. She's a very good nonfiction writer. She's got something coming out in summer called Imperfect Harmony, Finding Happiness Singing with Others, and it's about her experiences singing in a New York choir and about what singing does for us as a people, particularly singing with other people, and I think it's got real potential to be a very satisfying. I'll call Stacey Horn is always very satisfying, and that's usually one of the highest compliments I can give to nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And those are my look forward to titles. I've missed tons. There's a million of them coming out that are going to be good. And actually, at the Reader's Advisor Online, I should put in a little plug. We have a list of all the best of 2012 lists and also a few lists for 2013 ones coming. Also, the blog Large Hearted Boy does that too. He puts all the lists together of best books throughout the year.
Okay, and I will include those links on the blog when I post this episode in the show notes, so people can find that easily. Thank you. Thanks so much, Sarah, for talking to me and for giving us your list. I think you're the only person that went in depth about nonfiction, so that's very good.
Forward to hearing everybody else's titles, so that's fun.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Sarah.
Thank you, Steve. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Feels better. Bye-bye.
Hi, my name is Becky Spradford. I work at the Berwyn Public Library in Illinois, just outside of the city of Chicago. I also teach the Reader's Advisory course at Dominican University in River Forest, Illinois. I've been doing that actually for 8 years. I'll be starting a new semester any day now. I am also the author of the ALA Editions publication, The Reader's Advisory Guide to Horror, the second edition, which came out in April of 2012. So horror happens to be one of my loves and specialties.
Thanks for being on the show, Becky.
Thanks.
So you have a good little list for us here of the best horror of the last year?
Yes, I do. Actually, what was really interesting is this year, Library Journal, Neil Wyatt's Alert Collector column, asked me to give a list of the best books from 2012 that were in horror, and they told me I could do kind of whatever I wanted. I did provide links for you to put up on your blog of that column, but in it, I talked about one of the great things that happened in 2012 was that it was a great year for horror, and it really broke through to the mainstream. Not only was The Walking Dead just a huge phenomenon for the entire year, and lots of great horror movies came out all year long, but it was a great year for print titles in that there were books coming out that were really for every type of reader, from people who like science fiction to people who like literary. There were even some great nonfiction options. I do have that link to the six books I highlighted there, but two I want to talk about today in particular that were really big standouts. Sure. The first was Brett Talley's The Void. Brett Talley is an amazing new voice in horror. I'm going to talk a little more about the publisher that put him out in a few minutes, but he had his first book came out and was just widely acclaimed and was nominated for the best new author for the Bram Stoker Award. And then he came back this year with his second book, and thankfully it was not a letdown. It was called The Void. It got glowing reviews in Booklist, Library Journal, Publishers Weekly. You know what's so great about it is it harkens back to the old science fiction-tinged horror of H.P. Lovecraft, which has been around since the 1920s, but still is so popular today. In The Void, you enter a world where people easily can travel through space while sleeping. So people can now go really far away from Earth. But there's a catch. While you are traveling through space, sleeping, you are actually being held hostage to your nightmares while in flight. And these nightmares are somehow customized to your own greatest fears. And even worse, these nightmares have been known to drive people mad. But people still feel like it's worth it to get to explore space. So we start our story with six travelers, each who have their own secret, sort of, you know, that's driving these fears. And then they encounter this abandoned spacecraft where some travelers who had gone before them have been missing. And really bad things start happening, as in any good horror novel. But is it a dream? Is it their paranoia? Or is it actually some sort of alien monster? That's what's so great about the book, this creeping sense of unease from the very start. And that anxiety never lets up, which is what the best horror does. And it continuously builds, and you're just frenetically turning the pages to see how it all ends up in the end. It was just a great read. And Talley's a voice that's going to be there for a long time, and libraries should be carrying him.
Yeah, that sounds very Lovecraftian.
It totally is. And it's fun for people who like Lovecraft and really are sick of reading all those retreads of Lovecraft stories, which are fabulous, but at some point you want to see something new. Another book that people have really been talking about that I want to point out is The Devil in Silver by Victor Laval. This book actually made a lot of the 2012 best lists. It was in the Amazon list. It was in Publishers Weekly. And not just for horror, for all books. It really is literary horror. I like to say, imagine One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest meets a story like Frank Peretti's Monster. And in this book, our main character's Pepper. He's unjustly committed into a Queens mental hospital. And he quickly realizes that not only are the inmates more sane than the staff, but an animal-headed monster is stalking and killing the patients in this insane asylum at night. This is a story about characters. The action comes in quick spurts between Pepper's interactions with others and his internal struggles. And the omniscient narration is very eerie. It mostly follows Pepper, but it does switch occasionally in terms of the point of view, including an unsettling turn showing things through the eyes of a rat, which was kind of cool. It's a terrifying novel, but it also asks you to ponder the larger social questions of race, class, and madness. And, you know, this is important, too, to note that Victor Laval is an African-American horror writer, and it is still difficult, unfortunately, to find writers of color in horror, and I really hope that this moves it forward and brings some more of those authors into the spotlight.
Yeah, we can. It's equal opportunity scaring. So.
Yeah. And then, you know, another trend we saw in 2012 is similar to a lot of other fiction for adults is that the YA audience grew kind of exponentially in 2012. I had a couple authors back in October on my blog, RA for All Horror, talking about that and how they're changing and writing for YA. It got so popular that the Bram Stoker Awards, which are given out by the Horror Writers Association, they are the biggest awards in horror. I also happen to be a member of that organization, for full disclosure. They added a YA category for last year's awards. So many great YA category books were being written. And in the year before, they were being nominated in the regular novel category. And so they just, there was so much. They started that category. And it's, again, going strong this year. The recommendations are starting to come out that those of us in the Horror Writers Association give recommendations for what's going to be ultimately nominated. And there's a lot out there. But last year specifically, one of the best series, it was actually a trilogy by Jonathan Mauberry, his Rot and Ruin trilogy, ended with Flesh and Bone. And there's a couple other 2012 titles I think were worth a read for any reader of horror. A Bad Day for Voodoo by Jeff Strand, who happens to be one of my personal favorite horror writers. Such Wicked Intent, which is actually book two in Kenneth Opel's Bram Stoker-nominated The Apprenticeship of Victor Frankenstein series, which is a really great choice for people who are interested sort of in the history of horror, too. And then by a female author, Maggie Streifvader, The Raven Boys. This is scary. It's not. It is not teen YA with romance angle. It has a little bit of that, but it's on the scarier side. And those were some highlights in 2012 for those titles. One of the great things, other trends that happened in 2012 was that paperback horror came back from the dead. In 2011, it looked bad. The paperback horror was not being published. Leisure Books, which was the biggest producer of paperback horror with some of the big name authors, went under in late 2010. And the problem was, although ebooks were gaining in popularity, horror readers didn't really want to only read their horror in ebooks. Amazon did snap up the rights to the Leisure's back catalog and started a new science fiction, fantasy, and horror imprint called 47 North. But so far, the horror writing community and the readers who follow a lot of the writers have not been behind this new Amazon venture. After a few books, there is one, Seed, by Anita Alborn, which looks promising. I think this needs to be kept an eye on in 2013. The real reason the paperback horror titles have returned from the dead in 2012 is because of the diligence of small presses. They do the ebooks, but they also trying to make sure they get paperbacks out there. The biggest publisher that's doing that is Journalstone. I do have links on my blog to some information about Journalstone. But here's what Journalstone did, which I think is why they are the example for the small horror presses. They got multiple titles out in paperback and ready to be reviewed by the major journals. And the reviewers actually got them in their hands. They liked the books. Brett Talley, who I mentioned before, is one of Journalstone's biggest authors. They also run a annual horror fiction contest. And this year's winner, The Devil of Echo Lake, was a fantastic book. I also have a review of that on my blog. It got picked up by the mainstream reviewers, and they also loved it. They're really identifying new talent. They're supplementing it with some older, big-name people. And then the third thing they did, and really they're just marketing the heck out of everything they're doing, but they also got their paperback books in stores. One of their bigger books this year, The Donors, which again, I also have a review of if you're interested. They got on the shelves at actual Barnes and Noble stores. This was a big coup for them and for all horror small presses. And it's really going well for them. Again, all of them in paperback, all of them selling very well. And that was really 2012 in highlight form.
That's great. It's always nice when you can have a comeback story of a format like the paperback or something.
I think it's going to find a way to live in tandem with ebooks. Because we're talking about the trade paperback format. I think the mass market's pretty much done for horror.
Okay, and do you have some things to look forward to in 2013?
It's going to be a really big year for horror. We're going to start with the smaller stories and build up to the big ones. But 2013 has a lot for librarians to look forward to. First of all, the Horror Writers Association is doing a big push to market themselves to libraries, which means they're also marketing their authors to libraries. Under the leadership of dark fiction writer J.G. Faraday, they have secured booths at ALA Midwinter and in Seattle and ALA Annual in Chicago. I'm working with them. I'll probably be making some appearances at the booth in Chicago for sure. I am not going to be at Midwinter, but you should stop by and see them. They really want to work with libraries, and they want to increase the interest both in bringing authors to libraries and helping us to manage our horror collections and just talk. And that increase in interest that they see, they're doing it in advance of a big year of horror books coming out. Three of the biggest names in horror are having major releases this year. Let's start with the smallest of the three. That would be Jonathan Mauberry, who I mentioned before. He has a brand new entry in his New York Times best-selling Joe Ledger horror-esque techno-thriller series that's coming out in March. And then we move to Stephen King and his Spawn. Joe Hill has a very busy 2013, Joe Hill being the award-winning horror author and Stephen King's son. His long-awaited new novel, it's called Nosferatu, but it's spelled like a vanity plate for that famous vampire. So it's N-O-S, the number 4, an A, and a 2. It's going to be out in April. It's already one of the hottest advanced reader copies that people are trying to pick up and read. He also has the movie version of his novel Horns, which is starring Harry Potter, Daniel Radcliffe, in the title role of Ig, who is a young man who actually begins to turn into the devil. I do have a review of that book on my blog, too. And then finally, the conclusion of Joe Hill's popular and award-winning Lock and Key graphic novel series will be concluding this fall. Those do come out in installments, but then IDW publishes them in great hardcover-bound books that every library should have. I do have reviews of the first 5 in the series. I want to say, in my opinion, and I have said this at PLA, I have said it in print, Lock and Key is the best horror story that's out there right now. It has everything horror fans could want in a story. It also, I think, is one of the best graphic novels that's out there right now. One of the installments, I think it was the 4th one, actually did win an Eisner Award for best writing overall for any graphic novel. So I'm not the only one who thinks this. But I do want to remind people, even though this is popular and mainstream stuff, bad things happen. Apparently in the latest installment, and I wait to read them till they're all bound, you know, main characters do meet bad ends. And Joe Hill has apologized on his blog saying, I never promised happy endings for these people. But it's also really realistic and original and very scary. And then, of course, the most anticipated horror release of 2013, which is coming at the end of September. And that is the long-anticipated sequel to The Shining by Stephen King. Dr. Sleep is what the book's being called. There's a lot written out there about it. I really feel like this is going to bring back a lot of people to Stephen King. The Shining is still what I say is the best start with title for anyone new to Stephen King's horror. And lots of people have fond memories of the book and the movie. They're going to be coming back to Stephen King in droves. You got to make sure you are ready come September with enough copies, read-alike lists, maybe some displays to get people excited about the other horror offerings you do have. Because we want to capture this excitement about Dr. Sleep coming out. And we want to make sure that we're helping patrons find other great books to read, too.
And it seems like Stephen King has kind of moved away from horror of late, of what I'm remembering of his last few books. I mean, they're still creepy in a certain way, but they're more science fiction than, like, I mean, the JFK one, 11/23/64, and then Under the Dome even. The Dark Tower stuff, they seem to be, there's horror elements to them, but they seem to lean more towards sci-fi with horror elements rather than horror with sci-fi elements.
His last two books were that 11/22/63, which is a fabulous book, totally creepy, but mostly science fiction. And then he had another installment in his Dark Tower series, which would be dark fantasy. So this is going to be a really great return to not only classic horror for Stephen King, but to a beloved story that is going to be now being told in the future from the son's point of view. Greatly anticipate it.
Well, it sounds like there's lots of great things coming up, and it sounds like there's been a lot. There was a good past year as well. So
it's very exciting to see see a genre that you love really do well. I was getting a little down at the end of 2010 and into 2011. And that's actually when I was writing the book. So I was a little worried. And it's great to see just a rebound and the energy in these authors. And really, I do want to stress, contact the authors. They're all, a lot of the authors that I've talked about and others that you should be aware of are really accessible to the fans. And if you email them, they will get back to you. They really want to come to libraries. They, a lot of them don't have a lot of disposable income. Many of them have main jobs. I've talked to a few. One is John Epperson, who happens to live in the Chicago area. And he has a regular day job, but he's a great writer too, and has a book a year that comes out. And he will come to your library if you're local. He will Skype with you with your library. They just want to connect with librarians and readers. So reach out to your author this year.
I know Joe Hill is really active on Twitter too. So and a Tumblr and a few other things.
I'm following him on Twitter, and he does give shout outs to a lot of authors, which is really nice too.
All right. Well, Becky, thank you so much for coming on and giving us the overview of the last year and a little sneak peek of 2013 for the world of horror. And talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com, or you can follow the show on Twitter at @CircIdeas or on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. And if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.